Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is August 27, 1982, and this is my audio letter number 78. On the first day of this month of August 1982, a heart-rending symbol of the Beirut Holocaust appeared in newspapers all across America. It was a wire service photograph of a nurse in hospital in East Beirut cradling a small 7-week-old baby in her left arm as she fed it from a bottle. From the tip of the tiny nose upward, the baby's head was swathed in massive bandages, covering eyes and all. The little shoulders were wrapped in still more bandages. Where there should have been a pair of infant arms, there was nothing. The baby's arms had been blown off by an Israeli artillery shell landing near the Green Line separating East and West Beirut. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but in this case, the picture was worth a thousand sobs. Here was a tiny Lebanese baby, a brand new human life, ruined before it could even get started. The picture was a poignant object lesson about the senseless tragedy of war. At least, that is how most people probably reacted when they saw it. But the reaction of the Begin government in Israel was far different. When the picture was brought to their attention, they wasted not a word on trivial matters like simple human compassion, sympathy, or regret. Instead, they lodged bitter protests against the wire services and newspapers who had published the photo. There was great concern over the public relations impact on Israel resulting from that photograph. Demands were made that retractions be printed about the Israeli responsibility for the baby's grievous wounds. But to their credit, wire services here refused to make any retractions. It had been established very firmly that Israeli bombardment had caused the tragedy. To most of us far from the scene, that picture of a tiny baby horribly maimed for life may appear exceptional. But the fact is that the plight of that child has been repeated countless times in the Israeli rape of Lebanon. Recently, this was illustrated by the observations of a Presbyterian minister affiliated with Princeton Theological Seminary. The minister happened to be in southern Lebanon when the invasion began on June 5 and remained in Lebanon for several weeks into the war. Recently, he described what he witnessed in a talk in Ohio. The minister had seen for himself areas where the Israeli onslaught had caused not hundreds, but thousands of deaths, mostly of civilians. He also described the strenuous Israeli efforts to cover up the extent of the carnage and hide it from the outside world. In more than one case, Israeli bulldozers have even dug pits, shoveling in piles of bodies and covering them over. But the most nightmarish scene he described was one where a great number of children had been killed and maimed. He had come upon the scene when the cleanup had just begun. He was shown a room piled high with fingers, hands, legs, arms, and other parts of children's bodies. Here in the United States, the sheer enormity of the Israeli atrocities in Lebanon is being censored out. When we hear about disgusted Israeli soldiers leaving the front and returning to Israel to protest the war, we are unable to fully understand why. But elsewhere around the world, the news media are less hampered by the straitjacket of Zionist and Bolshevik censorship here in the United States. And what they are reporting is in full agreement with those personal observations by the Presbyterian minister. For example, on August 8, the BBC reported the observations of an International Red Cross official about the carnage in Beirut. He said that more than 80% of the casualties in Lebanon were civilians. And he insisted that the killing and bombing going on in Beirut was much worse than occurred generally during World War II. 2 days later, the BBC carried a report about relief women from Europe and New Zealand working in the Beirut battle zone. They had walked to the Green Line to protest the Israeli siege, which had cut off food, fuel, and water for West Beirut. One said, "These are the most horrible conditions I've seen in all our relief work around the world. And, my friends, the Israelis would not even allow the children in West Beirut to leave." Many of the military actions ordered by the Begin government in Lebanon can only be described as war crimes. Men who were Zionist terrorists in the 1940s control what has become the world's third most powerful military machine, that of Israel, in the 1980s. The result is what we have seen in Lebanon, state terrorism. This is military power used according to terrorist doctrine. In normal military doctrine, the most successful operations are those which minimize casualties. But in military terrorism, the opposite is the case. Every effort is made to multiply casualties for their own sake, with no distinction between combatants and civilians. To the terrorist, death is power. Throughout the siege of Beirut, we've seen the Israeli doctrine of military terrorism at work. On August 13, the Washington Post described the bewilderment created among Beirut residents by the merciless Israeli attacks. One was quoted in the words, "What is the sense of all this killing? What do the Israelis want? Are they crazy? The Palestinians have said that they are ready to go, so why don't they let them? Why do they continue to bomb us like this?" The answers, my friends, are all found in the doctrine of military terrorism practiced by the Begin government. What they want is total control through total fear. And to achieve that, death and suffering is intentionally increased as much as possible. These are the policies of genocide and of true war crimes. The war crimes committed in Lebanon by the militant Israeli Zionists are terrible to contemplate, my friends. But if we do not stop and think about them, we will not take seriously the plans for even greater war crimes to come. The Reagan-Begin axes of Bolsheviks and Zionists are working fast to commit the ultimate war crime, thermonuclear war. If they succeed, the agony of Lebanon will pale beside that of America. As I say these words, the hurry-up plan to set up nuclear war one is still on schedule. I first made public this shortcut war timetable 6 months ago in Audio Letter 72. In case it should fail or be delayed, longer-term intrigues to bring on nuclear war are also continuing worldwide. But as of this moment, my friends, the United States Pentagon is still counting down toward mid-September to set off a surprise nuclear war. This will be my last opportunity to report to you before Z-Day, the war target date now planned in mid-September. There is a chance that something dramatic will happen to halt the plan in the days that are left. I have received late word that the anti-war coup d'etat plans, which I first reported in Audio Letter 72, may not be totally dead after all. The Bolsheviks here did succeed in ousting the key man in that plan, General Alexander Haig, 2 months ago. But the Bolsheviks here are not certain that they succeeded in weeding out all of Haig's men. If not, then anything could happen in the next 2 weeks. Even so, action to prevent the war remains a long shot at this late date. If the Bolsheviks here do succeed in setting off a surprise American nuclear first strike against Russia, I want you to be as prepared as possible. There will be absolutely no official warning to the public ahead of time if the plan is attempted. But there are a few important warning signs to watch for in the news. I want you to know what they are and what they will mean if you see them take place. I'll also reveal the exact schedule for Z-Day as now planned. My hope is that by knowing what to look for and when, you'll be able to save yourself if the attack is attempted against Russia. My three topics for this audio letter are: Topic number one, the surprise halt to the Beirut Holocaust. Topic number two, final Pentagon plans for surprise nuclear war. And topic number three, the Russian surprise weapon for nuclear defense. Topic number one, when the Israeli invasion of Lebanon began 12 weeks ago on June 5, it was called Operation Peace for Galilee. Israel promised a nervous world that this would be only a limited operation with limited objectives. The Israelis gave their solemn promise that their armed forces would go no deeper than 40 kilometers, that is, 25 miles, into Lebanon. within that limited zone close to Israel, the intent was to eliminate all Palestinian fighting forces. Begin justified the operation in the usual sanctimonious terms, telling the world that Israel had been forced into doing it. It was the only way, he said, for Israel to buy peace for its northern provinces. My friends, from start to finish, the so-called Peace for Galilee operation by Israel has been a tangle of lies. The word peace was used to give a halo to the most genocidal war yet by Israel. And the biblical-sounding phrase, Peace for Galilee, was designed to hide the true nature of the campaign as much as possible from Christians in particular. When we Christians hear the word Galilee, we can't help thinking of our Lord Jesus Christ. The very word itself sounds sacred to us. So at a subconscious level, we are tempted to feel that we dare not condemn what the Israelis are doing. And feelings like these are reinforced by Zionist influence exerted through countless churches here in America. The counterfeit Jews, the Khazar Jews, who control Israel today, spend vast amounts of money to encourage counterfeit interpretations of the Bible. As a result, countless millions of well-meaning but misled Christians close their eyes to Israel's war crimes, saying, "It's all in prophecy." The Zionist lies about Israel's operation, Peace for Galilee, began even with the officially claimed date of the invasion. The agreed date used by the major media is June 6, when some Israeli forces went through a United Nations checkpoint. But the invasion actually began, as I pointed out in Audio Letter 76, on June 5, not June 6. It is almost as if, by changing the date of the invasion, the Israelis are trying to avoid the prophet Ezekiel's prophecy of doom. I quoted from that biblical prophecy in Audio Letter 76. The Israelis are fond of what they call creating new facts, but this is one fact they cannot change. To set the record straight once and for all, I now quote as an example from the New York Daily News for Sunday, June 6, 1982, Israeli tanks moved across the border into a Christian enclave in southern Lebanon yesterday, while Israeli warplanes and gunboats pounded suspected Palestinian positions, unquote. The date of the paper, my friends, is June 6. The reference to yesterday in the news article means June 5. Invasion of a country is a matter of fact, not words, and that invasion began with tanks crossing the border on June 5, 1982, the same day the official invasion order was signed. The Begin government began its abominations of military desolation in its sixth year, in the sixth month of the year, on the fifth day of the month. If the Israelis have incurred the wrath of God as spelled out in Ezekiel 8, it cannot be undone by lying about the date of the invasion. The extent of the Israeli lies about the purpose of the Lebanon invasion is almost beyond belief. But what is even more disturbing is the extent to which those lies have been successfully hidden from most Americans. The whole excuse for invading Lebanon was allegedly to end Palestinian violence against northern Israel. If you believe there is even a shred of truth to that, please listen to the following quotation. It's taken from an article by columnist Anthony Lewis, published in the New York Times of June 7, 1982. I now quote, "For 9 months, not a single rocket or shell was fired by PLO gunners into Israel. When Israeli planes bombed Lebanon on April 21 for the first time since the truce started, the PLO did not respond. When there was another bombing on May 9, there was a limited response, about 100 rockets that Israel said caused no damage or casualties. Then, after the massive Israeli bombing last week, the PLO responded with full-scale barrages. In short, the ceasefire kept the Galilee safe until Israel bombed Lebanon. The argument that aggressive new military action was needed to keep the rockets out turns reality upside down." End quote. My friends, it all boils down to the fact that the Reagan-Begin axis was determined to set off war in the Middle East. The timing of the war had nothing to do with any alleged provocations by the Palestinians. Instead, it was dictated by the joint plan of the American Bolsheviks and the Israeli Zionists to set off nuclear war very soon. That is why the Israeli forces did not even slow down when they reached their promised limit of 25 miles into Lebanon. The merciless bombardment and siege of Beirut itself had purposes far different from those stated. The presence of PLO headquarters there simply provided a convenient excuse for what was to be the invasion of an Arab capital. Throughout the Arab world, an Israeli invasion of an Arab capital has always been seen as the ultimate taboo. Had that been the outcome of the siege of Beirut, general war in the Middle East was virtually guaranteed, and that would have created the ideal cover to explain away the surprise eruption of nuclear war very soon. But, my friends, the Beirut Holocaust at the hands of Israel ended in a surprise. The Begin government had no intention of allowing negotiations for evacuation of the PLO to succeed. They kept turning the military screws tighter and tighter on Beirut, while adding more and more demands to be met by the Palestinians. Each time, the PLO confounded the Israelis by accepting demands which they had been expected to reject. As a result, time after time, Reagan envoy Philip Habib warned the White House that an agreement was becoming unavoidable. Each time that happened, Begin was notified, and the Israeli Air Force started pounding Beirut again. The result, time after time, was exactly what the Israelis wanted, a brief derailment of the talks. The cycle of talks, near agreement, and disruption by Israeli bombing took up almost the entire first half of this month of August, 1982. Foreign newspapers were filled with editorials condemning the bloodbath in Beirut and demanding that the United States rein in Israel. It was put more bluntly by the Morning Star, a British newspaper with Soviet ties. On August 1, the Morning Star declared that the United States on its own could end the siege of Beirut immediately if it cared to do so. But here in Washington, the entity President Reagan and his spokesman just wrung their hands as if they were powerless to do anything. The carnage in Beirut went right on with a continued green light from Washington. Meanwhile, there were a series of increasingly threatening growls about the Beirut Holocaust from the Russian bear. Russia's new rulers are as anti-Zionist as they are anti-Bolshevik, and they make no bones about it. On August 2, the BBC reported that Russia had condemned Israel as a barbarian committing genocide in Lebanon. On August 3, Moscow radio charged that the planning for the takeover of Lebanon had been done by the Defense Department in Washington. On August 4, the BBC reported increasingly fierce criticism of Israel and the United States by Russia. The next day, Russia called for a United Nations Security Council meeting, and at the meeting the next day, described the Israeli aggression as one of insolence and craziness. The exchanges between the Russian and Israeli delegates were some of the bitterest ever seen at the United Nations. While all of this was going on in public, the Russians were also flashing warning signs by way of diplomatic channels. The Kremlin was telling the White House to call off the dogs in Beirut, but Washington was not listening. Finally, the Russians decided enough was enough. In the small hours of Thursday, August 12, the entity President Reagan was awakened out of a sound sleep. He was told that Soviet President Brezhnev was waiting to speak to him on the crisis hotline. He was calling from his summer retreat in the Crimea. When Reagan picked up the phone, Brezhnev's message was short and blunt. Reagan listened as the slightly slurred words of an elderly man crackled over the phone in Russian. Then he turned to the interpreter, listening on a parallel phone. In effect, the message was, "Both you and your Zionist partners are deceiving yourselves. In the end, we will not permit a beachhead in Lebanon by your troops. Either you stop the Zionists now, or we will fix them ourselves. What's more, we know all about your September war plan. Don't do it." Reagan, who never makes a decision on his own, could only answer that he would check into it. As a Reagan-Brezhnev hotline conversation took place, dawn was breaking over the besieged city of Beirut. It was a dawn that had been shattered by the beginning of the most devastating bombardment yet by the Israelis. Israeli fighter bombers were shrieking overhead, diving toward the city, then pouring up as they dropped their bombs. Land and sea-based artillery shells were exploding within the city at a rate of more than one per second. The reason for the Israeli attack was very simple. A final negotiating session was scheduled for 4 o'clock that afternoon by Reagan envoy Habib and top Lebanese officials. Habib had warned the White House that unless something was done, an agreement was a certainty. So to prevent that, the Israelis unleashed everything they had on Beirut. The raids went on for 10 hours straight, from 6 a.m. until shortly after the meeting began. And it almost worked, my friends. Lebanese Prime Minister Shafik Wazan stormed out of the meeting with Habib in a rage. He declared negotiations to be suspended indefinitely. And afterwards, speaking of Reagan's man, Habib, Wazan said, "I have told him I cannot carry on, and hold him as well as the United States responsible for the consequences." If that had been the end of it, my friends, the Reagan-Begin Axis would have achieved exactly what they wanted. With the talks broken off indefinitely, the Begin government would have had the excuse it wanted to proceed with its all-out invasion of Beirut. The reason it did not end there was the Brezhnev-Reagan hotline call which had taken place that morning. The Russians had threatened to fix the Zionists, and suddenly there was evidence that they were preparing to do just that. Israeli air defense radars in Lebanon, on Israeli ships, and in Israel itself abruptly picked up a chilling sight. More than 100 unidentified blips materialized on radars all over the region. The blips were stationary, several miles up. It was a sight most radar operators in the area had never seen before. But when the reports reached Israeli and American air defense headquarters, the meaning of the blips was understood instantly. For the first time in several years, the Russian Space Command was making a massive show of force using its fleet of cosmospheres. These electrogravitic weapons platforms normally hover at the fringes of the atmosphere where they are invisible to radar. But on that afternoon of August 12, over 100 of them descended straight down to within radar range over Lebanon and Israel. Bolshevik military intelligence analysts here in Washington had to make a decision fast as to whether the Russians were bluffing or meant business. Because of the known anti-war attitude of the present-day Kremlin, Russian shows of force have not always been taken seriously here. But lately, the Russians have been doing things to change that. Last month, I reported on a whole series of warning shots which the Russians have fired across America's bow lately. They have been designed to show that the Kremlin is prepared to use its vast military power. With that was added to the Brezhnev hotline call, analysts here got a bad case of sweaty palms. It was decided that the Beirut invasion plan would have to be aborted. Somehow the PLO evacuation negotiations had to be started up again. Suddenly, all the excuses that America can't control Israel went out the window. Instead, evening news reports on August 12 led off by saying that Reagan was cracking down on Israel. There were planted stories that Reagan had called Begin and expressed outrage over the massive air raids that day. All of a sudden, after not lifting a finger for 2 months to stop the indiscriminate Lebanon massacre, it seemed Reagan had got religion. The following day, the Lebanese government agreed to resume the suspended talks over a PLO withdrawal. Suddenly, all the previous obstacles seemed to evaporate. Within days, the final agreement was struck. Barely a week later, on August 21, the first actual evacuation of PLO fighters from Beirut got underway, supervised by French troops. The turnabout by the United States and Israel was so radical and so abrupt that a scapegoat had to be found to explain it away to the public. For that reason, everyone started pointing fingers at the Israeli Defense Minister Sharon. There were rumors that he alone was responsible for the insane bombardment of Beirut on August 12. All kinds of stories suddenly surfaced to the effect that Sharon always was kind of insubordinate and dangerous. It was all his fault, we were told, but Sharon said it was the fault of the Israeli cabinet. My friends, the Russian power play saved Beirut from an invasion. But when the American Bolsheviks and Israeli Zionists caved in and gave up on the Beirut invasion plan, it was only a retreat, not a surrender. They are still as bent on nuclear war as ever, And the sooner the better, provided they can strike before Russia does. In the past, I've described how the Bolshevik nuclear war planners always make sure they have available not just one, but many possible paths to war. Having been thwarted in their Beirut invasion plan, they simply moved on to the next contingency plan. That plan involves the United States Marines who arrived 2 days ago in Beirut to supposedly help police the PLO evacuation. The plan is to stoke up a new crisis by creating an incident in which a number of Marines will be killed. In order to set the stage for it, the Israeli Mossad has already started creating so-called ceasefire violations, which are blamed on the PLO. Last Sunday, on August 22nd, there were news reports of an Israeli troop bus allegedly attacked by PLO guerrillas. Stories of that type are only to condition us for the planned incident to come against the United States Marines and Lebanese leaders. My friends, we have been told all sorts of lies that Israel's enemy in its so-called Peace for Galilee operation was the PLO. But on August 5, Israeli Foreign Minister Shamir revealed that the real enemy was Russia. Speaking to a group of Jewish leaders in New York City, Shamir said, "Lebanon until now was dominated by the PLO and Syria, and behind them, the Soviets." And he boasted, "Soviet Russia doesn't play any role now in our area." But a week later, Shamir found out differently when the Russian cosmosphere threat forced a surprise end to the Beirut Holocaust. 2 months ago in Audio Letter 76, I reported that the Israeli invasion of Lebanon was only part of the greater plan for nuclear war against Russia. Now, United States Marines have been introduced in Lebanon, with a promise by President Reagan that they will be needed no longer than 30 days. Before those 30 days are up, my friends, the Bolsheviks here intend to set off the surprise American nuclear attack against Russia. The countdown clock for the Project Z war plan, which I revealed in Audio Letter 73, is still ticking away. All preparations are now being targeted for Z-Day, the day of the planned nuclear attack itself. My friends, the exact date chosen by the Pentagon for Z-Day is Friday, September 17, 1982.